Bradley is the next case for argument this morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Nishay Stan, and I wrote...
I will call you when your opponent has managed to find a seat.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Mr. Stana.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Nishay Stan, and I represent the appellant, Jonathan Bradley, who was the defendant in the United States versus Jonathan Bradley. Your Honors, the issue before this court is whether or not the district court abused its discretion on allowing Mr. Bradley to withdraw his guilty plea or not.
And just to be clear, I understood this was so from the brief, but I just want you to verify. This is an all-or-nothing proposition. He wants to withdraw the entire guilty plea to everything, set the clock back to square one.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That is correct. And we believe the case law supports that. United States versus Peterson says it's an all-or-nothing proposition. And as Your Honor brought up previously, in this matter, the government is conceding that there was an abuse of discretion by the district court judge and that the guilty plea should have been withdrawn. Therefore, unless Your Honors have any questions, I will allow the government to argue their position. They concede in their brief.
Well, you might want to discuss what you think of it. The government's confession of error doesn't seem to track the arguments in your brief.
Well, Judge, respectfully, I disagree. I believe it does. The first, one of the big arguments that was raised in the district court level and in our brief, whether or not there was a predicate offense on the 924C. The issue was whether or not Mr. Bradley was guilty of a crime of using a gun in further drug trafficking of a crime. What they found in his vehicle, which is clear in the record, at most, and the defendant never concedes this.
Okay, well, let me then ask you what I will ask the prosecutor, and we'll see what she has to say at the time. The government's confession of error is based on the idea that the guilty plea constructively amended the indictment. And I have some trouble with that concept. Since the defendant can waive indictment altogether, and by entering a guilty plea, one waives all antecedent issues, is it ever possible, even in principle, to say that a guilty plea must be set aside on the ground that it constructively amended the indictment?
Judge, I believe a guilty plea has to be set aside if it effectively amended. I believe I'm understanding your question. If not, please advise.
Take a simple case. The defendant is charged with importing cocaine.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he stands up and says, I plead guilty to the crime of importing heroin.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? The judge says, fine. Factual basis is established that he imported heroin. Sits down, the judge enters judgment on the plea. Is there any problem with that plea?
Judge, I think there's a difference in what the charge in your scenario is a possession of a narcotic. Under 841, the charge of a possession of narcotic is what the charge is. The issue of what the narcotic is and what the quantity becomes a sentencing issue under Apprendi. But in the situation that we have here, which is a little more complex, is under 924C, the gun has to be used in furtherance of a drug trafficking crime.
Yeah.
What we have before this court, the possession of...
I have a dispute about what the drug trafficking crime was, but I'm perfectly willing to make my example clearer. The defendant is charged with importing cocaine.
Yes, Your Honor.
He then says to the judge, I plead guilty to the crime of tax evasion.
Judge,
the judge says, fine. Did you really commit the crime of tax evasion? And it says, yes. They go through the Rule 11 colloquy. It's clear he committed the crime of tax evasion. The judge bangs the gavel and says, your plea is accepted. And he then imposes a sentence. Is that invalid, essentially on the ground that it violates the defendant's right to be indicted for the crime of tax evasion?
Yes, Your Honor.
My question is, how can that be true, given that the defendant has an entitlement, maybe even a constitutional right, to waive being indicted?
Well, Judge, there was never, even if I come before Your Honor and I admit that I've committed tax evasion, even though I'm charged in front of Your Honor as a tax crime, I have the right before I can be sentenced under the Constitution to be charged with the crime that I'm admitting to.
You have a right, but there's no obligation, right? If you take my hypothetical,
yes, sir.
It would be perfectly clear if there were a written plea agreement and line one said, the defendant hereby waives indictment on the charge of tax evasion and consents to proceed without an indictment. Paragraph 2, and so on.
But Judge,
given that the defendant can waive being indicted on any offense, we come back to my question. How is it possible to say that a plea must be set aside because the defendant hasn't been indicted on that offense, but the indictment named a different way of committing the crime.
Well, Judge, in your hypothetical, using your hypothetical, there's an actual waiver to the indictment. In this situation...
Well, I was going to ask you, what would the standards for waiver be? Would they be implicit, which would be, I think, the import of what Judge Easterbrook's talking about? Would it be something like Johnson against Zerps? Would you want a knowing and intelligent, you know, clear relinquishment of a known right? You know, where are we on...
Judge, I believe there has to be knowingly relinquishment of the right, because how can a defendant make a knowingly decision to what he's going to plead guilty to unless he knows what he's charged with? Under the Constitution and case law, he has the right to know what he's being charged with and the right to plead guilty to that specific crime. There has to be a knowingly waiver, otherwise I could walk into any court and say I'm guilty of something and the judge can sentence me without even knowing that I'm being charged with that crime. There has to be some knowledge on part of a defendant before he can admit his guilt and be sentenced.
But the waiver of indictment itself has to be a knowing waiver.
That's correct, Your Honor. And going back to Judge Easterbrook's example, in his example, Judge Easterbrook, you put in there, I waive being charged for tax evasion, however at the time I'm pleading guilty to it. That didn't take place here. What took place here in the plea agreement is the charged conduct was knowing possession with the intent to distribute cocaine and possessing a firearm in furtherance of that. When we get to the plea colloquy, all we have is simple possession of marijuana, which is a completely different crime. He can't knowingly waive it until he knows he's being charged now with a separate, distinct crime. Possession of marijuana is very distinct than possession with the intent to distribute cocaine, specifically given the quantities involved in the sentencing guidelines. They're two very distinct crimes. I see my time's up. I'm going to save some time for rebuttal based on the questions that are asked to the government.
Ms. Hennage.
Good morning. Ruth Hennage for the government. In response to Your Honor's question and the constructive amendment issue that we raised, we agree with the appellant's counsel that there was not a knowing waiver here. Mr. Bradley could have waived the indictment, the right to be charged by indictment by the grand jury, but he did not do that. We're sorry that we're having to concede this case.
Well,
what case
should we go to look at to see whether this is legally required?
As to the withdrawal of the plea, Your Honor?
To see whether if you are charged with crime A and you plead guilty to something that, if it were done over your opposition, would be viewed as an amendment of the indictment, that is a legal defect. I notice your case didn't cite, your brief didn't cite any cases.
We probably should have gone into greater depth there, Your Honor.
What case would you now cite?
Oh, I'm sorry, I can't think of one, and I apologize to the court. We can.
Is this a confession of error that was authorized by Maine Justice?
It was not authorized by Maine Justice, Your Honor. It was authorized by the U.S. Attorney of the district. And if we've goofed up...
Normally, when the government confesses error, it confesses on the basis of some adverse decision. Here you're asking us to invent, so far as I can see, law adverse to the United States without any authority for that proposition, without any... checking to see. For all I know, if we accept your confession of error, the next thing that's going to happen is the Solicitor General is going to file a cert petition and say, what a bunch of jerks.
Well, we apologize to the court, Your Honor. The appellate, there were the high-level people in our district all approved our brief. The issue regarding the constructive amendment can be withdrawn, and the case would still be conceded by the government based on the arguments that were made by the appellant's attorney. The factual, there for count two, there was no proper factual basis. There was no compliance with the Rule 11 requirements that the defendant understand the nature of the offense. as well as understanding, as well as having a factual basis on the record. So we could orally withdraw. I'm not sure I have permission to do that this morning because my boss is not here, but the case can still be decided without that inserted. Then in terms of the remedy, we have agreed in our brief that the remedy here, assuming that the court agrees there was an error, that the court abused its discretion when it found that there was a proper factual basis for the plea, the remedy, we believe, is that the whole plea has to fail and that the case would be, that both convictions would be vacated.
As I read, am I correct in reading your brief, Ms. Hennage is saying you're conceding on two grounds, really. One is the fact that it amounts to a constructive amendment of the indictment, but the other ground is that it was simply guilty plea entered without the knowing understanding of the defendant as to what he was admitting to.
Yes, and we're, it's a very uncomfortable position to be in. Our office did not make it clear to the court. Judge Sharp apparently was not registering on the arguments that were made in the motion to withdraw the plea. The whole thing kind of got messed up. Different layers where it could have been caught wasn't caught. So, yeah.
It'll go back to the trial. For all we know, Mr. Bradley may regret his final analysis that this has all happened if he is convicted and winds up worse off.
Well, that could happen. Mm-hmm. And I believe he understands those consequences.
Mm-hmm.
But we felt that, first of all, we looked at count two, felt that there was an error, felt that the court had abused its discretion when it denied the motion to withdraw the pleas. We've not addressed the ineffective counsel issue and many of the other issues because we felt that the Rule 11 violation warranted the finding by this court that there was an abuse of discretion.
Well, it's not going to help the government much if this all goes through and then he files his 2255 on ineffectiveness of counsel and it gets undone then.
But we've not conceded that.
I'm sure you haven't, but I'm just saying if it were to happen, then he
would understand
that far, it would be much clumsier than it even is.
Well, it's fraught with problems, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
And apologies to the court for inserting the constructive amendment argument. Apparently it was not well thought out. We didn't realize, I guess, by adding that alternate issue that it would create some concern on the part of the court. Are there any other questions? If not, then we'd rest on our brief. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Sandman?
Your Honor, we have nothing further. We'd rest on the briefs and the arguments that were made and that this matter should be reversed and remanded and the guilty plea should be withdrawn as to both counts.
Okay. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.